The biggest thing today is to not brush over this. If anybody's reading ahead, they know that we're in Daniel 6, and it's a very something, if everybody was raised in church, something you're, a story you're well acquainted with, and it'd be kind of easy just to read through and kind of blow it off. But, you know, the point of this is to try to dig a little deeper and to make sure that it's applied in our lives now, as opposed to just being a piece of knowledge that we store in our brains for, I don't know, Bible trivia or something. So we're in Daniel 6. If you'll remember, last week we saw the Babylonian Empire fall. As powerful it is, it fell without a fight. It was due to, you can see the consequences of poor leadership. Evidently, Belshazzar, which was Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, was quite the partier. And as serious things were knocking at his door, he decided just to keep right on partying, and it was his undoing. And if you, history, we kind of watched a little video. It's the Medo-Persian Empire, and Darius is an interesting character in that his mother was a Mede, and his father was Persian. So he kind of is the perfect meld of those two groups of people. But as we're going to see as time goes on, that one part of that will become the stronger. As it's kind of interesting that you can't serve two kings, you know, and that'll be played out in here. So, Daniel, here's this guy. Now he is, when people don't know exactly when this took place, but he was around 82 years old when Babylon fell. That was what most scholars think. Again, I ain't a scholar, so we're just going by what other people say. So some amount of time has passed, so people believe he could be like 83 to 85 somewhere. So he's not a spring chicken when all this is going on, and his career is just amazing when you think about he's a teenager, basically kidnapped, because they were held for ransom. Not ransom, but they were held as a price to keep other people from, yeah, rebellion and a trophy and blah, blah, blah. And then in the Babylonian kingdom, he rose up and was basically second to the king. And we're going to see that, you know, here, as you would think, in normal circumstances, when one kingdom falls and another kingdom takes over, they kind of wipe out all vestiges of that kingdom. But Daniel so impressed Darius that here we are with Daniel again in another leadership position. So, verse 1, and it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom satraps to be throughout the whole kingdom, and over them would be three presidents, of whom Daniel was one, to whom these satraps would give account, so that the king might not suffer loss. So, you know, good management skills here. He's not going to try to micromanage. He's going to put a group of people over the country, but then he's going to put three people over them to report to him, to keep him from suffering. I'm sure, you know, there was no banks or whatever, then everything was kind of done on a cash basis, if you will. It was easy for people to skim money off the top or, you know, whatever, that the king wanted really, really sharp guys in charge of his stuff so he wasn't losing anything. So, then in verse 3, then this Daniel became distinguished above all other presidents and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. So, obviously, we know the spirit that's in him, who that is, and so he's become such a good, I mean, you know, what an amazing... We've all had jobs and been where and failed at being that good guy at work. But Daniel isn't that guy. And he's so good that now Darius is going to make him again number two in the kingdom. It's almost like the Joseph story relived again. And with everything in life like that, being humans, when somebody's doing well and excelling, there's always somebody that's not happy with that. And we're going to be introduced to those guys. Then the president and the satraps.
I have one question. Didn't Jesus say that, when we talk about the Spirit, he had not yet been given?
Well,
when I was reading that, I was just thinking about it.
Agreed, but I'm going back to the Old Testament as far as like the Spirit comes and goes more than just a constant indwelling. That when, you know, when Daniel needed to make a big decision, he, you know, turned to the Lord and the Lord would bless him. I mean, that's kind of what we saw with the dreams and all that kind of stuff. But you're right, the indwelling does not come until the New Testament. So that is a thing there. So the presidents and satraps sought to find ground for a complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom. But they could find no ground for complaint or any fault because he was faithful and no error or fault was found in him. What a kind of a testament that, you know, again, I mean, Daniel's not a type of Jesus, I don't believe, but it's kind of interesting that at the crucifixion that said, I can find no fault with the man. And again, we see that here that, you know, we always live as Christians believing we'll never be accused, we're doing, but there are false accusers, and it's a pretty blatant thing. Now, I've seen people with little fish on the back of their car driving like idiots that, you know, I'm sure people have complaints against, but those don't have anything to do with the Spirit, right? But so when no error of fault was found in him, that's just a great compliment to him. Then these men said, we shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God. It's kind of interesting. I meant to point out at the beginning that after Babylon, Daniel's no longer referred to as with his Babylonian name. He's called by his Hebrew name from now on. And holy cow! So and it's so here he is being referred to with his name, and these people have, you know, quite the quandary in that he's such a good dude. They're not going to find anything wrong with him unless they can make it in connection with his God and the laws of his God. So obviously Daniel's a very upright and, you know, righteous person. Then these presidents and satraps came by agreement to the king and said to him, O King Darius, live forever. So that's kind of the, I mean, we've seen that all through, yeah. And it also goes all the way back to Egypt when all these kings have always claimed God status, that they're directly, they have the divine right to rule because they're descendants of the gods, if you will.
But that's the jobs of those magi.
Right. And that, so, you know, here they're kind of kissing up and they're already, I guess our vernacular would be blowing smoke. So all the presidents of the kingdom and the prefects and the satraps, the counselors and the governors are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes petition to any other god or man for 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. So here they're really stroking Darius's ego, right? He's like, probably not even thinking, and it says all of the king. So you don't know if they're telling the king this or if they, it's hard to get anybody to agree on anything, a large group of people, but it does say all, but you don't know if this is just their way of trying to make it a kind of like the COVID vaccine, right? Everybody's
when
doing
you have lots of leaders and you have people in charge who feel like they need to be important, they make up laws
and then
that
hurt
people for no reason.
Again, we were discussing whenever there's something that everybody agrees on, something's wrong. Right? There should be a couple voices going, well, I don't know, maybe we need to slow down on this a little bit and take a look at this, but obviously that's all these people are jealous of
Daniel. Daniel's not there, so it's not all.
Right. Now, O King, verse 8, now, O King, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. So this is an interesting turn in human governance, if you will. One way that they discovered to make the king not above the law was to make the king subject to the law, and he couldn't just change it at his own whim. He couldn't make a law and then say, oh, I messed up, that's not law anymore. Now, you were, and you kind of see this all the way in the book of Esther, where the king passed a law that they were going to kill the Jews, and he couldn't do anything about it. The only thing he could do was tell the Jews, hey, these people are going to attack you, defend yourselves. You have the right to defend yourselves. He couldn't revoke the law. So it's kind of an interesting historical, this is kind of the first place that kind of plays out. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber toward Jerusalem, got down on his knees three times a day, and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. So this is basically his Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego moment when he's basically saying, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. This is my God. This is how I worship. Whatever happens, happens. And, I mean, you don't get the feeling. If Daniel was some other person, you knew he would be doing it, like, flagrantly, like, just to be rebellious. But you get the feeling this is just what he did every day. And he's like,
it's
nobody.
What they saw to come in and
right.
catch him. They already knew how.
But he's just doing what he does every day. And that's pretty interesting that they can trap him in that. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and plea before his God. So obviously, I mean, you get the feeling they kind of stormed into his chamber and found him there doing what he does. Then they came near and said before the king concerning the injunction, O king, did you not sign an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man within 30 days except for you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing stands fast according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. So they've just played him big time here, and he's just cemented it by being kind of bold. Then they answered and said before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or the injunction you have signed, but make his petition three times a day. So they've been watching and know. And it's kind of funny because they say, he pays no attention to you, O king. But here for all this time, he's been taking care of the king's money, been over to kings. So this is the kind of, false accusations that people, they're, again, like, I guess, doing the opposite of stroking the king's ego, or stroking it in a way that makes him even more angry. That says, hey, Daniel's just ignoring you.
I think it's a good lesson for us how to live in the world, that as it comes to your job, you do it under the Lord until it becomes where they tell you you can't, it interferes,
with your work.
Yeah.
Then the king, when he heard these words, was much distressed and set his mind to deliver Daniel. I think that's a pretty bold statement there, too, that the king really, really appreciated him, and now he realized he's stepped in his own trap. And he labored till the sun went down to recuse him, I guess either one would have worked. And so, I mean, it's pretty awesome that he's trying to figure out a way to let Daniel off, because he knows Daniel's character. He knows who he is. Then these men came by agreement again. Everybody's coming by agreement. To the king and said to the king, know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or ordinance of the king established can be changed. Then the king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. The king declared to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you. And a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that nothing might be changed concerning Daniel. And, you know, we've all seen this with the ring, and they pour the hot wax on whatever, and then the king would impress. Usually the ring had his face or something on it that would denote his family. And so you knew if the wax ring was broke that somebody had gone into the, it was sealed.
Typically what you did, what you don't pay attention to, is the lords also sealed with a signet ring because they didn't trust the king.
Yeah, well, yeah, because they had to be in agreement, yeah, that he wouldn't let them out either.
Because it usually takes one seal to seal something. It doesn't take the lords to also seal the signet ring.
Then
I have one question, though. Because it makes it sound like this is just like a cave or something.
Mm-hmm.
Was this like common practice to have?
Evidently, they've discovered these caves in part of the world.
These lions were put there, and this is how they...
Yeah, this is how they dealt out part of their justice system.
Okay. That's where they kept Fluffy.
Yeah. You got to imagine, this is a pretty...
Instead of a cave, it's probably a pit.
Yeah.
So that they can watch and entertain, like when you go to the zoo, how they're dug out and they all hang out down there, but you're above. It's probably more like that because of what happens at the end.
I never thought about that. Maybe that was something they kept there.
Yeah, they've discovered these places where these lions. Right. Well, that was the, you know, the criminal justice system was harsh back in them days. You didn't get a couple of appeals or whatever. You just, you know, guilty, into the pits, goodbye.
Spoiler alert, in the next couple of verses it says that the families were killed before their feet even hit the ground. So they must have irreparation.
Terrible.
So then, verse 18. Then the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions were brought to him, and sleep fled from him. So he's pretty upset about this. He must really, really care for Daniel and appreciate... You know, Daniel's probably done a lot for him, and he's probably one, you know, being the king, as we've seen throughout history, you can't trust everybody or you're not the king for long. So he probably realized that Daniel was somebody he can trust, and that's got to be really hard for him to lose that person. Then at the break of the day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. And he came near to the den where Daniel was. He cried out in a tone of anguish. The king declared, Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? So that's, again, a pretty bold statement coming from the king saying, servant of the living God. So he's, I don't know, he's seen God in action in Daniel's life, you have to say at this point. That, and then, oh, you continually serve, has he been able to deliver you from the lions? Can you imagine, I would assume there's some part of him not expecting to hear a reply. And then Daniel says, O king, live forever. So now he's kind of flipped the script on the guys that, he's the one praising the king instead of being on the bad side of the king. My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth, and they have not harmed me because I was found blameless before him, and also before you, O king, I have done no harm. So, and of all interesting, we know that what does Satan go about roam the earth as? A roaring lion seeking whom he can devour. So, this is one of those cases where you're given a physical example of a biblical principle that Satan cannot hurt anybody that the Lord is protecting. And that's his agreement with you. Then the king was exceedingly glad, which is a very cool place to be on the good side of the king, and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. So I think I saw a thing where you could walk in, but then, like you said, you could see down into these things, so they would just lower a rope and bring you up in a basket up out of there. Because, again, you can't break the seal on the door. So I guess at some point they would have to break it. And Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no harm was found on him because he had trusted in his God. Another bold statement. And the king commanded all those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and cast into the den of lions, they, their children, and their wives. And before they reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces. So that's a pretty gruesome way to die. Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, "Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall, and of his dominion shall be to the end." So it's kind of interesting. I thought here it was kind of interesting the way that I get a feeling that Daniel told him about Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Right? Don't you get the feeling that he's basically declaring this is the rock that's going to knock down all the other kingdoms, and his kingdom is going to live forever? I don't know. I just got the feeling from that. And he delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in the heaven and on earth. He who saved Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So I thought it kind of interesting here. I started looking up bones. And because we all know that the crucifixion, one of the rules was Christ would not have any of his bones broken. So Psalm 34:19-20 says, "He, one who is righteous, has many adversaries, but the Lord rescues him from them all and protects all his bones. Not one of them is broken." And then Exodus 12:46 says, and this was talking about the sacrifice for the Passover, "It shall be eaten in one house. You shall not take any of the flesh outside the house, and you shall not break any of its bones." So, under Hebrew law, you know that if you could not eat something with its blood still in it. That the blood was represented life. And obviously that Jesus shed his blood became an important factor. But, you know, now we know the physiology is blood cells are created in the bone marrow and stuff like that. So you get the feeling that God is continuing that if you're, by letting you die and breaking your bones, I'm destroying your life. That's like the final, most heinous thing that can happen is your bones to be broken. As opposed to, I mean, we know Jewish burial is, you put the body in the grave and sits till all the flesh is deteriorated off of it. Then you put the bones in a bone box, and then that's how the body is stored. So the bones aren't broken. There's nothing. That's part of the life of this being that lives. So I think it's
wouldn't the opposite of that be? I'm visualizing as you're talking, so I see this pit being maybe a story tall, two stories tall. And didn't you say Daniel was what, 85?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I was 85 and I was thrown two stories down, I mean, like, I don't picture them just gently dropping him in. I mean, I picture them like.
Well, I think, honestly, in
but it's not one bone was broken. God even saved every bone. I mean, he walked out with no injury.
Well, I think with these, you could actually walk in, and then the cave was sealed behind you, because they obviously didn't throw the lions down two stories.
Keep them alive and healthy, too. Place judgment on.
But didn't it say Daniel was thrown into the pit?
Mm-hmm.
Does it say
for the
don't know. That's probably one of those.
Either way,
it's a miracle. And,
connected, yeah.
Yeah. And his bones were not broken. Yeah.
I pulled Tyler, what, 3 foot off of a ladder? Or miss one step on a ladder?
Yeah.
You can break bones easily, right?
Yeah.
I mean it.
But there's something really, I kind of just did a Google thing on bones in the Bible, and it's kind of interesting that kind of thought is maintained throughout the Bible. It says, you know, when God judges somebody, it says, this and this happened, and their bones were scattered. You know, that there's really something in that, a spiritual principle in that, the bones being broken. Now, I'm not saying it's a spiritual principle. You're in a car wreck and somebody dies, and, you know, they have a couple broken legs. Oh, they were unrighteous.
Jesus Christ, was it Joseph? He was fighting someone, and he broke their...
He took their hip out of joint with Jacob. But it doesn't say he broke anything. He just took his hip out of joint. All right, so... We have a few minutes. We might as well delve into this, and we'll probably come back and go over it. But I'm assuming this, up to this point, we've been pretty much in the historical part of Daniel, which I've tried to show, and I will be showing you more maps and stuff. But now we're kind of going into the territory. So I guess that everybody was mostly interested in what we call prophecy, which is, you know, trying to foretell the future in the sense that God wants you to be aware of this, and it's one of the way he reassures you that his word is from him and that he is the only one that can see things, the beginning from the end. And so therefore, when he says these things and they come true, we consider that quote-unquote prophecy, whereas in the Jewish perspective, it's more you have a model, if you will. We have you know, the model of Ruth's husband Boaz as the kinsman redeemer. You know, you build these models, as a Western mind, more as prophecy, as, you know, a statement is made, and then at some period in the future that statement is fulfilled. So that's kind of where we're going to go here. So we kind of step back, because this is going to be Daniel's vision of what God sees, those same kingdoms that Nebuchadnezzar saw as gold and silver and bronze and iron. We're going to see them through divine goggles, if you will, as what God sees them as. So in the first year of Belshazzar, King of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. And Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. So, throughout the Bible, again, constant, the great sea is usually humanity. It's a way of depicting humanity constantly in turmoil, constantly, you know, waves and battering people and that kind of thing. So four great beasts came out of the sea, different from one another. So we can see up out of humanity, and this great swirling mass comes these four great beasts. So the first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth and between its teeth. And it was told, arise, devour much flesh. After this, I looked, and behold, another, like a leopard, with 4 wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong, had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the other beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. So this is obviously where we're going to go into, and I encourage everybody to do some homework and come up with different, I honestly tried to win it, and some of them I was telling Sam this morning, some of them were so kooky I couldn't even include them. I was going to have something to kind of balance what I found against them. Some of them are just outrageous. So it says, I considered the horns, and behold, there came up from among them another horn, a little one, before which the three first horns were plucked up by the roots, and behold, this horn, there were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. And it said, then it's, I meant to take that out, this is just a highlight in the study Bible. So verse 9, as I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head was pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. A thousand served him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment. Again, we go back to the group of God. We, you know, this divine counsel, if you will, as opposed to God just, he seeks to have a family and he has people around him that he allows to make decisions. We see that a couple times in the Bible. And the books were open, and I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking, and as I looked, the beast was killed, its body destroyed, and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like the Son of Man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom is the one that shall not be destroyed. Verse 15, as for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all this, so that he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. The four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever. Then I desired to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the rest, exceedingly terrifying, with its teeth of iron, claws of bronze, which devoured and broke into pieces and stamped what was left with his feet, and about the 10 horns that were on his head, and about the other horn that came up before which three of them fell. And that horn had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things, and it seemed greater than its companions. As I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High, and at that time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. Thus he said, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth which shall be different from all the other kingdoms. It should devour the whole earth, trample it down, and break it into pieces. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be different from the former ones and put down three kings. He shall speak words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and shall think to change the times and the law, and they shall be given into his hands for a time, times, and half a time. But the court shall sit in judgment again, and his dominion shall be taken away to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and his dominion and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. Their kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey them. Here is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me, and my color changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. So he was obviously greatly, greatly affected by this. And in the little bit of time we have left, we won't be able to go through the whole, which, again, I don't know. I believe that anybody says they know what all this means and all those things, I don't know if I would take their word for that. If I was, I think there's a lot of I'm going to go through and present to you one version. Again, we'll have to go, obviously, back through this next week. But anybody who wants to go out there and do some homework and find different parts of this, you're welcome to do that. Like I said, I tried, but the ones I found were so bad. So, look this up. So if you look at, this is what mostly is, like I told you, how people perceive these. This was the Daniel 2. This is a direct correlation with Daniel 2. Daniel 2, we saw how men perceive these kingdoms. And in Daniel 7, we see how heaven perceives these kingdoms. So in 7:4, it says, "The first was like a lion, had eagle's wings. Then as it looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand with 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it." So automatically we think back to Daniel 4:33. "Immediately the word was fulfilled against Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from among men and ate grass like an ox. His body was wet with the dew of heaven, till his hair grew as long as an eagle's feathers, and his nails were like a bird's claw." So we kind of see, to me, again, it's open for conjecture. So I went back, it looks like, you know, we know that eventually he was restored. So his wings were plucked off. He had the wings of feathers, like an eagle. But we see they're plucked off. He's lifted off the ground. He's restored. And he's given the mind of a man where he praises God because he's seen God in all his glory. And so, like, so one of the things I saw was a person that, his thing was that all these creatures were actually the Babylonian kingdom after Nebuchadnezzar, and it just fell apart. You couldn't get very far through it because you could, even I could poke holes in it. So again, if anybody wants to go out and research,
you know, I have no idea. I, that's the first thing I can say, but as I was reading this stood out to me. It was an old, a commentary. And it says, the first year in Daniel 7 represents a flashback to 553 B.C., 14 years before the Feast of Five. The Feast of Five says 7 and 8 actually are, they're going back. They should be inserted after 4. And then comes the feast. So if you think of it, you know, and then, of course, this chapter goes all the way to the, you know, this is talking about the, you know, Revelation. And
well,
so it's covering a lot of territory, and I really have to have spiritual effort to serve.
Yeah, okay. But what's interesting with all this, sort of, this is called the 400 silent years. This is the temple years. There's no temple in Jerusalem. It hasn't been built yet, and the one that was there has been destroyed. So everybody calls this the silent years, but I think God's kind of telling you it's not silent. There's things going on, and I have control of this, but it just doesn't concern my people right now. I'm going to let the world just rage. You know, it goes back to Psalm 2, right? Let the nations rage in vain, and that's all. You know, Nebuchadnezzar, as soon as he heard that other people were going to replace him, he built a statue out of solid gold, basically to flick, you know, point his finger in God's eye and say, I'm not giving up. And that's humankind. That's what, you know, we've done throughout human history. So we'll go on to the second one if everyone's... This is me just kind of trying to make it... Like I said, I hate the fact that this is what everybody agrees with. But I did go through and try to see how you could logically come to this conclusion. So 7:5, and behold, another beast, the second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told to rise, devour much flesh. Well, when the Medo-Persian Empire came into being, they had conquered 3 empires. That's the 3 ribs in its mouth. I commit. And again, it's kind of interesting. We were talking about broken bones and what that means, that you're, you know, desecrated. So Egypt, Babylon, and Assyria were all conquered by the Medo-Persian Empire. and raised up on one side, eventually the Persians, it becomes the Persian Empire. The Medes just kind of fade away. So that's this bear rising up on one side is one side of that two-headed kingdom becoming the more pronounced, if you will. So anybody have, so we pretty much just, at this point, we're making the argument that Babylon is the first beast, Medo-Persia is the second one, now we'll go into Greece. 7:6. After this I looked, and behold, another like a leopard, with four wings of a bird on its back, and the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Interesting fact, Alexander had conquered the known world before he was 30. He was lamenting that there was no more wars to fight, got sick and died, but he had no heirs. So all, when on his deathbed, and this is, you know, some of this could be conjecture, you don't know, but supposedly on his deathbed, the four generals asked him who would get the kingdom, and he basically said, let the strong have it. So the kingdom was divided into four places. I have a map, we can see that. And what's going to be very historical about that is, okay, so it's four kingdoms, but two of the kingdoms border on Judah. So for the rest of Greek history, that Judah exchanges hands. We'll see the abomination of desolation comes out of that. All kind of history comes out of those two kingdoms warring over that little piece of land in the Middle East. All right, so we'll go to the last one. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful, and exceedingly strong, and had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces, and stamped what was left to its feet. It was different from all the other beasts that went before it, and it had 10 horns. And I could have put, I kind of ran out of it, but you see it at the bottom. Rome was the one empire that reveled in destruction. They just didn't want to come take your town over like Babylon. They were going to raise it and build it back in the manner that they saw fit. And what's kind of interesting, there's a biblical archaeology show I watch. And the best preserved Jewish and Christian things in Jerusalem were the ones the Romans buried and tried to hide, but they basically protected them. So now, as these archaeologists find these things, they're in great shape because the Romans buried them for not for those purposes, because they were going to build temples to Zeus on top of them and all this stuff, but they ended up preserving for posterity's sake the heritage that we have in archaeology. Alright, so I got a bunch of, just a real quick, we can go back. So here you can see these beasts I went through. There's the Babylonian Empire. So you see how big that kind of extends over to the edge. Then the top right is the Medo-Persian Empire. Then you see where it kind of stopped. Then you see Alexander's Empire, how far it goes all the way into India. And then last, this is the Roman Empire. So you can see how each kingdom grew and grew and grew. And not only grew in its size, but it grew in its ferocity. So, and here, it's kind of interesting, this is basically, if you're going to argue that the Romans are the last, this is the 10 kingdoms that made up the Roman Empire. So when it says there were 10 kings, you could make the argument that this is those kings. These are those areas. So, that's it for today. We'll pick back up. I know that was, we'll have to go back over that, because there's no way you can rush through all that. And anybody that comes up with a different plan, different anything, present, feel free, take over. Alright, I'll pray real quick so we can be done. Dear Heavenly Father, just thank you for this day. Thank you for the time together. Thank you that we have a place to worship, and that we're allowed to worship, Lord, and just forgive us for all the times we failed and weren't good witnesses like Daniel was with just our actions. And again, just thank you for all we have. And just help us to be thankful, just not just at this time of year, but always, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.
I've heard the case before that the Roman Empire still kind of exists in the Catholic Church.
Well, that's in your mind.
Yeah.
So much.
But it was never conquered.
Right, it was never conquered. So there's the four kingdoms of Alexander. And see where the secular empire is, the tan one,
yeah.
How it meets the other empire down in Alexandria. And they both border Judah.
Yeah.
Right there. See where the... Let me see if I can make up.
That's what we were talking about.
Won't let me go. Can you see that? Yeah. So right here, this is constantly fought over. Right here, this area.
Okay.
And you can see, it just... I mean, what an amazing plan to have. Not be... Well, and what I was going to talk about the next week. So when you guys say, well, God gave you a land of milk and honey, you had to realize that people were going to want that. You know?
That adds up. Yeah.
Yep.
So that's awesome.